From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Hillary Clinton is back on the world stage. What did she accomplish this week in Asia? I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Secretary of State Clinton covered a lot of diplomatic ground this week, from new agreements with India to an appearance at a regional conference in Thailand. Clinton also generated some sparks with her comments on Iran and North Korea. Did she break new ground this week? What agenda is the U.S. developing for relations in Asia? Does Clinton's high-profile trip mean that she's taking a more active role in Washington? On Reporter's Notebook, a Nobel Peace Prize winner on trial in Myanmar, the case of Aung San Suu Kyi. First, the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with To the Point from PRI. We'll be talking today about Hillary Clinton's trip this week to Asia and about the controversy stirred up by her comments about Iran and North Korea. The 3 days she spent in India won rave reviews from the local media. But will the U.S. focus on India generate problems with Pakistan? There's been a lot of buzz in Washington, D.C. lately about whether Clinton has been sidelined by the Obama administration. Does this trip represent renewed influence for Clinton with the president? On Reporter's Notebook, the Myanmar military junta's case against Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi is winding down in a courtroom in Rangoon. The trial has sparked international outrage, but will it affect the verdict? First, this news update. President Obama today announced a major initiative to move the nation's schools towards reform. With Race to the Top, the president pledged more than $4 billion in economic stimulus money to help state governments that accept more charter schools and performance pay for teachers. Here's part of what the president had to say.
Because improving education is central to rebuilding our economy, we set aside over $4 billion in the Recovery Act to promote improvements in schools. This is one of the largest investments in education reform in American history. And rather than divvying it up and handing it out, we are letting states and school districts compete for it. That's how we can incentivize excellence and spur reform and launch a race to the top in America's public schools.
That was President Obama this morning. Joining us now is Michael Shear, who covers the White House for The Washington Post. Thanks for being here.
Sure. Nice to be there.
Tell us about the press conference today. Were there any surprises in what the president said? What was the main thrust of the proposal?
Well, you know, there weren't any surprises, really. My colleague Nick Anderson and I had a chance to sit down with the president in the Oval Office a couple of days ago to talk about this and had a story in the paper this morning. And basically, that clip that you played captures is essentially the idea. They've been, already over the last several months, traveling around the country, the Secretary of Education has, on behalf of the president, essentially making the case that these states have to change the way they do business on educational matters, they have to be open to more charter schools, have to move towards merit pay. And if they don't, the warning has been very blunt from the White House. You aren't going to get any of that money.
How does this as a break from President Bush's attempts to reform the education system with No Child Left Behind?
Well, it's a similar approach in the sense that both were an attempt to impose some kind of standardization and some kind of national sense of what needs to be done on the local systems, which both recognize have been very resistant to change. I think the thing that's slightly different here is that rather than kind of take the approach that the money should be distributed nationwide in a kind of effort to broadly get everybody to change at once, This program is aimed at saying, look, we're only going to give this money to the places that are serious about change. And, you know, the hope from the White House's perspective is that if they can show that the people that take this money actually make positive results, that actually you see student test scores improving and dropout rates falling, then perhaps you can then broaden it to the rest of the country. But that's really the distinction between the two.
So it sounds like perhaps there's more flexibility, whereas the No Child Left Behind was enforced across the board, leaving resentment among teachers who felt they were being forced to meet, or some teachers at least, being forced to meet certain test scores. It sounds like this is more almost like an economic incentive package.
It is. I mean, the one thing that has created a little bit of tension, though, in the way that they're handing it out, the president definitely stresses it as a sort of incentive-based approach. There are several, though, states that have really felt almost like they've been the subject of a shakedown a little bit because the administration has come in and said to various states, look, you better change your laws. We want you to change your laws. Otherwise, you're going to be frozen out. The state of California, for example, is pushing back against some early assessment from the administration that some of their laws disqualify them from getting any of this money. And that, you know, that has definitely created some tension.
What about the teachers' unions? How are they responding?
Well, it's a sort of a mixed bag. You know, I don't cover education full-time, but my colleague tells me that, you know, the idea of merit pay, for example, has really sort of shifted over the years. There was a time when I used to cover schools, local schools years ago, that the word merit pay was considered a, you know, absolutely verboten in union circles. Now I think there's a little bit less of a sort of automatic resistance to it or an automatic opposition, but there's still a wariness. You know, there's still a sense that, you know, if you're a teacher and you're judged by solely by, say, the test scores of your students, you know, that could be wildly misleading. You could have a lot of good teachers who wouldn't be who wouldn't be rated very highly because of some of the students in their class. And so, you know, I think they're sort of publicly saying that they support this effort and, you know, but also saying, look, you know, we got to see sort of where it goes.
Okay. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks, Sarah.
Mike Scheer covers the White House for The Washington Post. He was talking with us about President Obama's press conference today to announce Race to the Top, a major education reform initiative. We'll be back in a moment with To the Point on PRI.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
I'm Sarah Terry. We're back with To the Point. When Hillary Clinton sits down for an hour-long conversation on Meet the Press this weekend, she'll have a lot to talk about. She's just returned from a trip to Asia that made a lot of headlines, a spat with North Korea, a surprise promise to protect the region if Iran gets nuclear weapons, and a series of agreements with India. What does Clinton's trip mean about U.S. intentions in the region? And what does the trip say about Clinton's influence in Washington? My first guest today is David Rothkopf. He's a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and a former senior official in the Clinton administration. His latest book is Superclass, The Global Power Elite and the World They Are Making. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Tell us a bit about Mrs. Clinton's trip this week. It made a lot of headlines overseas. She was a little eclipsed occasionally by news here in the United States. But how significant was this trip?
Well, I think it was significant on several levels. I think from a policy perspective, she's decided she wants to focus on major powers. And in her estimation and view of the world, India certainly fits that bill. So going to India and really sort of saying to the Indians that this is a country that's at the center of U.S. priorities or top U.S. priorities was certainly an important thing to try to achieve. It has ramifications for the relationship with Pakistan. It had ramifications for climate as an issue, which was extremely important. It had ramifications regarding the U.S.-India nuclear deal. Going to Thailand, she was able to send yet another message, which was this was a regional conference that Condoleezza Rice had not gone to in recent years. She was able to say the United States is back and was able to address important concerns about Myanmar and about North Korea, as you mentioned a moment ago. That said, you know, that's sort of high policy. There's a kind of an inside the beltway dimension of all of this, and that is that during the first few months of the administration, there was a lot of buzz about her not being center stage as much. and a lot of, you know, sort of whispering about whether she was being kept off the center stage by the Obama team or she was choosing to be a workhorse and not a show horse as she has been in the Senate. But in any event, whether it's that or her broken elbow or whatever, she had not really been highly visible. And this is certainly her most visible week in a long time, which is going to end on Sunday with an appearance on Meet the Press. And so from that perspective, she has reestablished herself center stage. And that not only has a political ramification, it also has a ramification for her effectiveness as Secretary of State.
You've done a great job of laying out, in fact, the structure of the show that'll be coming up over the next 30 or 40 minutes. I want to unpack what you've been talking about just a little bit and start with going back to her emphasis on major powers. Is that something that the Secretary of State decides on her own or in consultation with the president? And what does it mean to say you're going to concentrate on relations with major powers?
Well, every administration makes its foreign policy differently, but at the center of every administration's foreign policy is the president. He's the one who determines who has power, who he listens to, who he gives time to, and what his priorities are. I think in this administration, you've seen, though, a decision to take certain issues like the Israeli-Palestinian issue or Iraq or Afghanistan-Pakistan and put them in the hands of people other than the Secretary of State, some of whom actually report to the Secretary of State, but, you know, these special envoys. And so that's meant that if she was going to focus on those things, she'd be in a bit of a crowd. I think that there has been a calculation on her part, and a smart one, that where their space is wide open and where the most sort of return on an investment of her time can be generated is on focusing on the relationship with Europe, with Japan, with China, with India, with Brazil, with Russia, this new constellation. I mean, one of the big things that's happening right now in the world, we're focused on a lot of things here in the United States, but one of the big things that's happening is that the head table of the world's being reseated. You know, it used to be the G8.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the G8 anymore. Maybe it's the G20 or maybe it's going to be the G14, but these big emerging powers are now part of the inner circle, but the relationships don't exist. The dialogues have to be established for the first time. And so This focus of hers fits with what Obama has talked about, but it also gives her a place where, you know, she can be the strongest figure.
Give us some more background as we for entering into the conversation a bit further. In terms of how this approach, you've touched on it a bit here, but how in particular this approach to Asia may differ or does differ from what the Bush administration did.
Well, you know, certainly, for example, if you take the Thailand trip, wherever they get the chance, the Obama administration goes in and says, we're committed to multilateralism. We are as far away from the Bush administration's real or imputed unilateralist stance as we can be. We want to work with our partners. So that's part of it. I think part of it is different because, you know, in the past year, the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, have actually kind of institutionalized their relationship with foreign ministerial meetings and leaders' meetings. They're becoming more of a collective force to be reckoned with. And so she's saying, in going to India, we recognize that things are changing and that we have to put these relationships front and center. On things like North Korea, there's not a huge difference between the Obama administration's policy or the Bush administration's policy. It's more a question of how we view getting things done. And are we more likely to act alone, as in the Bush administration, for one reason or another? Obviously, they didn't want to, but they found themselves doing it a lot. Or are we more committed to working in partnership with others? And I think the president, I think Secretary of State, want to see that as a hallmark and communicate that as a hallmark of their policies going forward.
We're talking to David Rothkopf. He's a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Let's bring our next guest into the conversation, Ambassador Teresita Schaefer. She's a former ambassador to Sri Lanka. She's now at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, South Asia Division. She's the author of India and the United States in the 21st Century, Reinventing Partnership. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. My pleasure.
Let's talk a bit more about Secretary of State Clinton's 3 days in India. The emphasis this trip placed on India, understand it, I think she's only the second Secretary of State to exclude Pakistan while on a trip to India. How would you assess what she was trying to build specifically with India on this trip?
Well, I agree with most of what David said. I think what she was really trying to do was to put this administration's stamp on the relationship with India. Interestingly, policy towards India is the one area where the Bush administration picked up a lot of what the Clinton administration had done, and the Obama administration has picked up a lot from the Bush administration. The difference is in two important respects. One is the question of style, and that touches the things that David was talking about the Obama administration wanting to make clear that it wants to work with other countries, that it is more multilateral than its predecessors, and so on. And the other, which is going to be a little bit more complicated, is that I think the Obama administration wants to take the bilateral ties that have been built up with India over the past two administrations, expand them, but take the partnership global. And at one level, this fits in very well with where the U.S. and India are at the moment. First of all, what they have discovered over the past 10, 15 years is that in the post-Cold War world, their interests largely coincide, whether you're talking about Indian Ocean security or Asian peace and prosperity. Or there's a whole host of other things. India sees the United States as one of the keys to their taking on a larger role in the world.
Now, of course, there were defense contracts were a big part of Mrs. Clinton's trip in India, the possibility that India could now buy some $57 billion worth of defense-related materials over the next 3 years. How significant was that?
Well, the big decision was actually one that the administration inherited from the Bush administration, the decision to allow American companies to bid in India on the basis that they could also do co-production was the critical decision that made it possible for U.S. suppliers to be serious bidders on those defense contracts. What was agreed on during Mrs. Clinton's trip was a technical requirement for any significant defense sales from the United States. It's called an end-use monitoring agreement. This is something the United States requires and a number of other suppliers don't. It was something that the Indians found strange and not very comfortable. After working through it for a lot of months of the Bush administration and the first 6 months of the Obama administration, they decided that they were willing to do this, that if this is what it took to get U.S. military supply, that the language that they had worked out with the United States was going to be acceptable. So the agreement itself was a technical agreement, but it was a necessary part of implementing a bigger defense relationship with the United States insofar as that defense relationship was going to include significant military sales.
Was there any kind of a trade-off in this in terms of building up the quite large number of small arms sales, trading off with trying to discourage India's nuclear intentions?
I seriously doubt it. Mm-hmm. The Bush administration, of course, had concluded the civil nuclear cooperation agreement. The Obama administration inherited it, and Secretary Clinton has made very clear on behalf of the administration that they are fully committed to implementing it. Now, that part of it has nothing to do with the military sales stuff. The parts that remain to be done in order to have the nuclear agreement fully implemented, I think also aren't amenable to being traded off against anything. There's a couple of things the United States needs to do having to do with our rather complicated licensing process. There's a couple of things India needs to do having to do with liability legislation. And there is one major piece of unfinished business, which I think is going to be a difficult one for both sides, which is that the nuclear cooperation agreement negotiated under the last administration included an undertaking to begin negotiating a safeguards agreement that for reprocessing and enrichment. The Obama administration has said that they will begin these negotiations. beginning and finishing are two very different things. Every stage of this nuclear agreement has taken much longer than either side expected because they are difficult issues. India is trying to preserve maximum flexibility and is very sensitive about being treated as a lesser power than the nuclear weapon states recognized by the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The United States doesn't want to break any unnecessary crockery on the non-proliferation side, and frankly, this administration cares more about non-proliferation than its predecessor.
Let me just interrupt for just one second. We've just got a few minutes left. I think we have to address, though, the question of what this focus and these conversations between the United States and India do to Pakistan.
The watchword in the past two administrations has been dehyphenating the relationship. I think they've been fairly successful in that. Obviously, this is not an absolute, because if you're making policy towards India, you're going to be aware of the reaction in Pakistan and vice versa. And, of course, India and Pakistan are going to make very sure that you are aware of the ramifications. So Pakistan is uneasy about this. I think basically they're going to have to live with it. The sting in the tail when it comes to relations with India is that India is always concerned that the U.S. is going to come to them and say, you need to help us out on Pakistan. And they are afraid that that request will be at the expense of things India considers absolutely vital. And the current example of that is pushing Pakistan to take serious action against their terrorism infrastructure and against the people who were apparently involved in the attacks on Mumbai. So I think Secretary Clinton got through her visit without having had any serious differences of opinion on that. I'm sure they exchanged views behind closed doors, which is the way to do it on that subject. But the issue is going to be with us for some time.
We've got just a minute left, and I think it's important to touch on the issue of global warming. India rebuffed Secretary of State Clinton's approaches on that.
Yeah, India and the U.S. have had different views for a long time. India does not want mandatory caps. They think it'll interfere with their economic growth. The U.S. said we don't want to interfere with India's economic growth. And Todd Stern, in Secretary Clinton's entourage, redefined what the U.S. was asking countries like India to do, to mean that we were asking those countries to slow down the increase in their emissions. We haven't figured out how to square that circle. What we're both going to need to do, though, since obviously the U.S. and India both have to be part of the solution if there's going to be a solution, we're going to have to figure out how to expand the debate and the negotiation beyond the single issue of emissions caps.
Okay.
And I think Secretary Clinton's visit to the LEED building is a step in that direction.
Thanks. We're going to have to take a break now. Ambassador Teresita Schaefer, former ambassador to Sri Lanka, thanks so much for joining us. She won't be able to be with us in the second half of the show, but we will return to David Rothkopf and a few more guests on Reporter's Notebook later on. The trial against Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi is winding down in Myanmar. Will the outcome be affected by international protests on her behalf? Back in a minute with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney today on To the Point. We're talking about Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and her trip this week to Asia, the relationships with India, her comments at the ASEAN conference in Thailand, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. We're going to focus a little more specifically at the moment on what she had to say about Iran. Here's a soundbite from what she said this past week.
The focus that Iran must have is that it faces the prospect, if it pursues nuclear weapons, of sparking an arms race in the region.
Our next guest is Barbara Slavin, Assistant Managing Editor for World and National Security of the Washington Times. She's also author of the book Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies, Iran, the U.S., and the Twisted Path to Confrontation. Thanks for being with us.
You're quite welcome.
As we focus on this part of the Secretary of State's trip and what she had to say about Iran, she also indicated that if Iran that it wasn't going to be secure for Iran to step up a nuclear arms race of any kind, and in fact that the U.S. would be willing to provide a defense shield in the region. Well, how significant were her comments this week?
Well, it's interesting. We couldn't get anybody at the Pentagon or the White House to comment on them, which suggests that she might have been talking a little bit off the cuff. If you may remember, during her campaign, her unsuccessful campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination, she talked about offering a nuclear umbrella to the Gulf Arab states in the event that Iran were able to build a nuclear weapon. And it may be that she simply reverted back to that campaign language when she made this comment. We have not been able to get any details about whether there are real plans to extend this kind of umbrella. But I think it is fair to say that U.S. defense relations with the countries of the Gulf Cooperation Council, that's Saudi Arabia and a bunch of other little countries along the Persian Gulf on the Arab side, are closer than they've been at any time because of what is perceived as an Iranian threat.
And in terms of how she addressed Iran within the context of Asian nations, what was the point of that conversation?
Well, Iran does sort of straddle the Middle East and Asia. It has relationships with India, with Pakistan, with other countries that make it appropriate, I think, to talk about Iran. And, of course, it's very much on the mind of everybody because of the nuclear program and also because of the domestic developments in Iran that have been just extraordinary since the June 12th presidential elections.
It's interesting, as you pointed out, that the Secretary of State sort of may have gone off message or off the Obama administration's message with her comments on Iran. What kind of problems does that make or not when you're trying to set foreign policy in a region, especially one that's as sensitive as Iran?
Well, it's very delicate. And actually, you saw that there was almost an immediate reaction from the Israelis and Israeli Deputy Prime Minister Dan Meridor. Blasted it. He interpreted her comments as suggesting that the Obama administration has already accepted the fact that Iran will have nuclear weapons, something which the secretary and her people immediately denied. But it is very sensitive. If you talk about a defense umbrella for the Gulf states, you're talking about a containment strategy, which, you know, to some people could suggest indeed that there is a recognition that perhaps nothing that anybody can do will stop Iran from developing nuclear weapons if it so chooses.
We're talking with Barbara Slavin from the Washington Times about Mrs. Clinton's comments this week while she was on a trip in Asia about Iran and its nuclear intentions. You've indicated that perhaps she was a bit off point for the Obama administration when she made those comments. She also made headlines on her comments on North Korea earlier this week. She said, you know, what we've seen is a constant demand for attention. Maybe it's the mother in me or the experience I've had with small children and unruly teenagers. And she goes on to say they're asking for attention. Don't give it to them. I'd like to talk to you, David Rothkopf from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, about the somewhat, not poetic perhaps, but the comment back from the North Koreans in which they compared her in one sentence to a primary schoolgirl and sometimes a pensioner going shopping. What was going on with this diplomatic exchange or undiplomatic exchange this week?
Well, first of all, I think we have to, you know, embrace this. You know, most diplomatic exchanges are really kind of boring. And this
North Koreans were pretty good on this one,
yeah,
I admit.
No, they were good. I think that may be kind of a high point literary output of North Korea. But
I want to meet the guy who wrote it.
Yeah, well, exactly. But hopefully it didn't alienate his leader, or he may not be available for you to meet. But, you know, I think it started out with Hillary Clinton probably talking off the cuff in a way that she shouldn't have. You know, comparing the leader of North Korea to a small child, which, while, you know, accurate, is almost inevitably going to produce this kind of an outburst. The fact that they then responded by saying she was a schoolgirl or, and this was even, I think, more painful, you know, a pensioner, you know, going shopping, that was just, you know, horrible. But it does emphasize one thing, you know, beyond the kind of the edgy language, and that is, this is a war of words. Mm. The North Koreans know it's a war of words. The United States knows that it's a war of words. Every time they, you know, launch a missile, we don't take action against them, but we get something else passed in the United Nations Security Council. It's taken on an almost surreal quality of sort of serial tantrums from one side or another. It does tie to your earlier point with regard to Iran. Unless you're willing to go in and use military force to stop a country from having nuclear weapons, countries are going to get nuclear weapons. The problem, however, is not, in the case of Iran, whether Iran as a state is going to take action against its Gulf neighbors. The problem is, as we have a proliferation of nuclear weapon states, it increases the likelihood that fissile material or some weapon is going to fall into hands of a rogue actor or terrorist, some other bad guy, who's much more likely to use it than a state is. Hmm. And I think that's where the real risk comes. There are 25 countries right now considering creating nuclear programs. Now, most of them, I mean, all of them say that they're civil programs, but they all have a downside for security. And wars of words, even colorful words, are not going to be able to contain that.
David Rothkopf was with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Barbara Slavin of the Washington Times, you've covered national security quite broadly. Can you tell us how you would assess, especially in the light of Mrs. Clinton's trip to Asia, the comments on Iran and North Korea, how the Obama administration is laying out an agenda for dealing with the very issues we've just heard David Rothkopf talking about?
Yeah, well, I have to say that the engagement strategy is not going so well. I must admit, I love North Korean propaganda. It must be so much fun to write these.
Well, I just have to actually share the first sentence of that. We cannot but regard Mrs. Clinton as a funny lady.
A funny lady. They also said her comments were vulgar. Now, this is not new. I mean, President Bush called Kim Jong-il a pygmy, as I recall, and said he loathed him. And they had some choice words for him as well, and also for John Bolton, who I think they saw as the incarnation of evil and vice versa.
Okay, we're going to start. I can see a book.
A
book is going to be written on this soon. I can see it happening. Twitter.
But apart from the silliness of the rhetoric and the fact that really I don't think anybody should get down to this level, not us or the North Koreans, behind it is the fact that this engagement strategy isn't working very well. I mean, Obama came in saying he was going to talk to all these people that Bush often refused to talk to or would only talk to with preconditions. The Obama administration has not even been able to get an envoy to Pyongyang, and actually the Bush administration succeeded in getting Chris Hill, the Assistant Secretary of State for Asia, to Pyongyang. The Bush administration had Bill Burns, who was then the Assistant Secretary of State, I believe, sit down with the Iranians last summer, and the U.S. has not had any luck getting the Iranians to nuclear talks. Now, admittedly, the Bush administration didn't get anywhere in those talks, but it's been, I think, very frustrating for the Obama administration that that these overtures and this willingness to engage has not been reciprocated by these states.
Well, you've pointed out that Mrs. Clinton's comments reflect a frustration with the fact that engagement isn't working. Does it indicate a lack of knowing how to move forward? Would you be expecting to see a different articulation from the administration, or more specifically from Mrs. Clinton on these issues?
Well, you know, these things never work unless all the stars are aligned, and it's so rare that happens. I've argued in my books that the Bush administration had an opportunity after 9/11 to really improve relations with Iran, and it didn't take advantage of that opportunity. Now you have a situation in Iran with absolute domestic political chaos. I mean, we really don't know whether the president is going to be re-inaugurated in a week or so. In North Korea, you also have a domestic crisis. Kim Jong-il, the leader, is reputedly very ill. There's some reports that he has cancer. He had a massive stroke last year, and he is supposedly trying to groom his younger son to succeed him. And, of course, North Korea feels very vulnerable during these periods of succession and doesn't want to show any hint of weakness, which may explain the nuclear tests, the missile tests, and some of this very, very belligerent language that they're using against the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. So it may not really entirely be the Obama administration's fault, but, of course, they're stuck now, you know, having come in with this policy and not seeing any fruits.
Barbara Slavin and David Rothkopf have been doing a good job of laying out sort of the international power politics that have surrounded Mrs. Clinton's trip to Asia. Let's turn now to some of the questions about the Secretary of State's relationship within the Obama administration and on Capitol Hill. Ben Smith is a senior political reporter for Politico.com. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What does this trip say about Mrs. Clinton's relationship with the president? A lot of chatter around whether she'd been sidelined. She came back in an interview recently and said, you know, I broke my elbow, not my larynx, you know, indicating she was perfectly satisfied with her relationship with the president. But what's going on?
Well, Clinton was more or less invisible by choice over the first 6 months of the administration, was not giving interviews, was not not doing very many television appearances, and wasn't making, you know, questionable statements about the North Koreans and getting herself into trouble. It was very cautious, and I think her people around her were concerned that at a perception that she'd vanished, that she was being marginalized. Although I think what she was trying to do was to make allies within the administration, to be a good soldier. But so in the last few weeks, we've seen her really kind of come out and assert herself quite a bit more. She gave a major policy speech last week in which she kind of really is starting to assert herself as an independent character within the administration.
And what does the opportunity for her appearance on Meet the Press this Sunday provide for her in further establishing her role as Secretary of State?
Well, you know, it's funny. There had been this one of the kind of lines of people who were whispering that she'd been marginalized was that she's never on the Sunday shows, because that's, you know, of course, the premier test. And in fact, this was by choice. She had been offered, I'm told, by the administration, three different opportunities to appear on the Sunday shows, turned them down, went on this week, last month. But this is kind of the premier Washington stage, and I think it's really just it's a chance for her to appear as the primary American spokesperson on foreign policy, which really President Obama has been to this point, not her.
It's interesting, actually, that even this week, while her trip made headlines overseas, got a lot of attention from press in the region, here in the United States, there wasn't a lot of press on it. Our conversation was dominated by Obama and health care reform. Why is that, do you think?
Well, I think that is how the administration would like it. Tom Donilon, the Deputy National Security Advisor, who runs a lot of this stuff day to day, said to me that her celebrity is this extraordinarily useful tool for them, and that's the word he used, because she goes abroad and she dominates the headlines there. She's received by heads of state and by, you know, important officials who do not feel like they're getting some flunky sent because the president doesn't have the time. She can call people up and they don't feel like they're getting, you know, some second tier player in the administration. That's very, very useful for the White House
to have a very high profile person that they know it's a Clinton who's calling.
Yeah, exactly. It's a global celebrity who's
There's
calling.
There's a cachet. So,
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a useful tool. And so they certainly encourage her to, you know, I think it was in Indonesia. She did like a daytime television show, like kind of The View there, and it was a huge sort of sensation over there early on. But she had not until quite recently done any domestic press. I mean, I think she's trying to now maintain a profile, but ultimately, I mean, the reason that she took the job, and I think in one of the rationales for picking her early on, was that Obama would be so preoccupied with the domestic crisis that he wouldn't be able to handle foreign policy, or he wouldn't be able to devote the kind of time to it he would like to.
Well,
that's not really what shaped up in the first 6 months.
Yeah,
he was everywhere.
Exactly. We certainly, I mean,
but
among
now that's, yeah,
the
but
other
now
major-
there's Yeah.
Among the other major headlines was Obama in Africa very recently. I'm curious if you have a president who's actually, as you pointed out, not according to plan, is becoming his own sort of secretary of state in a way. What role does that leave for Hillary Clinton?
Well, that's the problem for her, is that he's very personally interested in foreign policy. He's very engaged. He has a very distinct view, and his identity is very wrapped up in it. You know, I mean, Hillary Clinton can't go to Cairo and say, I have Muslims in my family, and I can and look at a country who elected me president. I mean, Obama's message is just all wrapped up in his identity. And so ultimately, he's the messenger. Although right now he is totally engaged in a domestic fight and will be for quite a while, and so there is a space for her now, I think, to do some of what people around her had hoped she'd do more of, which is really be the administration's primary face on foreign policy.
Ben Smith is a senior political reporter for Politico.com. Barbara Slavin, assistant managing editor for World and National Security of the Washington Times. Over to a final comment from you about Mrs. Clinton's role with the administration and what she's likely to affect on the world stage.
Well, I would agree that she's had a little bit of a slow start. I mean, obviously, she does have to defer to the president, but we don't really have a signature issue for her. I was at her Council on Foreign Relations speech the other week where she laid out this supposed vision, and it was really very thin. It was a lot of process. There was jargon, you know, multi-partner world instead of multipolar world, this sort of thing. An emphasis on development, on people-to-people diplomacy. But, you know, we've heard these things before, and she doesn't really have a signature issue yet. There is a plethora of special envoys who are dealing with the most crucial aspects of administration foreign policy. So I think there still is a question out there about whether all this celebrity that she does bring, all this obvious talent, will be well used to advance U.S. foreign policy. I think the jury is still out on that.
Thank you, Barbara Slavin. David Rothkopf from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Last minute of the show to you with your thoughts on the role of Mrs. Clinton, on what kind of an agenda we'll be expecting to see in the months and years ahead.
Well, I think the role of Secretary Clinton is almost inevitably going to expand. The first 6 months of this administration, the policy of the administration has largely been Barack Obama. He's different from George Bush. He has a different view, and that's fine for the first 6 months, but he's got to move on to managing a whole array of other things. The foreign policy agenda is going to build up. He's going to need to delegate more to her, and she's one of the most highly capable people in the cabinet. So I think that, you know, we'll soon forget that this period was a little quiescent for her, and we'll see her take on a variety of more aggressive roles. Now, whether everybody in the White House is going to be totally comfortable with that at all times, that remains to be seen.
Okay, thanks so much. David Rothkopf is visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thanks, too, to our other guests, Ambassador Teresita Schaefer, former ambassador to Sri Lanka, Barbara Slavin from The Washington Times, and Ben Smith from Politico.com. On trial in Myanmar, Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi faces up to 5 years in prison in a case that the international community says is bogus. That's coming up on Reporter's Notebook. We'll be back in a minute with To the Point from PRI.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. In Rangoon, lawyers for Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi wrapped up their closing arguments today. Prosecutors will present theirs on Monday. In a case that has won widespread international condemnation, Suu Kyi is charged with violating house arrest because an American man swam to her lakeside home earlier this year. The trial has dragged on for more than 2 months, and a guilty verdict is considered likely. My guest is Min Zin. He's a teaching fellow at Berkeley, the University of California at Berkeley. We're fortunate to have him. He worked with Aung San Suu Kyi in Burma. He's a former journalist. He was in hiding in Burma for about 10 years. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
What information is reaching you about the trial? Journalists are not allowed there, although some foreign observers have been.
Well, actually, they postponed the trial to Monday. That's upset the opposition, the Aung San Suu Kyi's lawyers, because, like, you know, in the trial process, when the Aung San Suu Kyi's lawyer already submitted their closing argument, but the regime prosecutor, they took time to preparation until Monday. So usually both sides should at the same time submit the closing statement, but what the regime did is they postponed the trial so that the prosecutor will have more time to prepare for their closing statement. That's really not fair. That's what the lawyers told us. And the thing is, like, many people already expect the possible verdict. According to the military soldiers inside Burma, they said the senior general Tan Shui, the top military leader of the regime, already told the court, "I want to see her at least in the behind the bar for the next 3 years," because he does not want Aung San Suu Kyi to take part in the next year election. So he wants her to be behind the bar at least another 3 years.
The military junta, as you're pointing out, is concerned about her presence, her popularity among the people in next year's elections. In this court case that's been going on, the reports have pointed out that the prosecution has had a heavily stacked case. They've been able to call more witnesses versus the defense. How is the government able to even portray this as a fair trial?
Well, the thing is, the government was planning to give a verdict very quickly in the beginning, but when they found out the, you know, like anger, you know, and also like outrage from the international community, they was quite stunned. So that's why they delayed the, you know, the trial. And the thing is, there are two arguments from the Aung San Suu Kyi's lawyer. The first one was that, you know, it was the responsibility of the security forces who guarded Aung San Suu Kyi's house arrest, because, you know, what happened now is it was not the first time. It was the second time in 2008. The same guy who swam to her house and who invaded her house, but she did not meet him at the time. She informed the authority to take action against that, you know, like the invasion. But authority did not take any action. And then this year, they allow him to get a visa and to visit Burma again. So that many observers believe the military deliberately, intentionally let it happen so that they can charge Aung San Suu Kyi, you know, again and put her behind the bar. And the second reason is more technical reason. The law she has been charged right now is a part of the constitution that was abolished by the military and 21 years ago. So, I mean, this is no ground legally to charge against her on this law. So that's why, like, many people think this is like bogus. This is military is basically buying time to give an impression that they are doing fair trial, at least so that they can get support from their you know, like usual defender like China.
You're pointing out, of course, the some of what have been perceived as the absurdities of the trials. You've said she's being tried under a law that was abolished, in fact, by the junta 2 decades ago, and that she was being held responsible for a man who swam to her house, even though she's under house arrest. The question being, wouldn't that be the responsibility of her security guards? And, of course, these comments, these have been noted by the international community. There's been a lot of complaints, a lot of protests. Will that protest by the international community have an effect on the verdict, do you think?
I think it all depends on China. I think, like, China is a major ally, a major supporter of Burmese military government in the international bodies, including United Nations Security Council. And also China is a like, major supplier of arms. And also China give a lot of grants and, you know, aids to Burmese military. So China hold the key. If international community could manage to get China on board, you know, in pressure in the Burmese military, they might give second thought. Otherwise, they will go ahead and like give sentence to Aung San Suu Kyi.
Aung San Suu Kyi, of course, is a very well-known figure on the international stage, even though she hasn't been heard from much due to the house arrest and the restrictions placed on her by the junta. She had won election many years ago, Nobel Peace Prize winner. You worked with her. You know her. We, you know, outside of Myanmar, haven't heard much about her. Can you tell us what you know of what kind of spirits she's in? There have been some questions about her health. What can you tell us about her?
Well, I mean, when I was involved in politics, I was only 14 years old. I was only high school students. I was involved because of my brothers and sisters. They were university students. They were get arrested by the military. And the first time I met Aung San Suu Kyi, it was a very amazing. You know, in the Burma is like traditional hierarchical society. I mean, in this society, she is the only person who treat young people with the genuine respect. You know, I had met several veteran politicians, I mean, who treated me as their grandsons and, you know, never discussed about politics. But it was Aung San Suu Kyi who really treated young people like me, like the same age of her son, with the respect. And, you know, she listened to me. She noted down. She argued against me. She even laughed with me. I mean, this is a, I mean, she did all these things with a wise observation and authenticity. So I think to me, she is a, I mean, not only to me, but also to ethnic minority leaders in Burma. I mean, Burma is a, like multi-ethnic societies. I mean, she paid respect. She listened to the people. This is the society that never experienced that kind of, you know, equal respect, you know, relationship. So she's amazing, I mean, to my experience. The other thing is her health. I mean, she is very frail and very weak right now, even though apparently she's such a strong and like a high spirit, but her health is very weak, according to her doctors. So my concern is like military consistently, I mean hardliners in the military consistently are plotting to assassinate against Aung San Suu Kyi. So they did several times. In 2003, they attacked Aung San Suu Kyi and her convoy when she traveled to Upper Burma. About like 100 people got killed. She made narrow escape. So many people believe they want her to prolong, to languish in the prison so that she died by herself in the prison. So that's our concern. That's many people in Burma, I mean, they are really concerned about this issue.
Just briefly, in the last 30 seconds or so we have here, will Secretary of State Clinton's comments about the Suu Kyi trial this week make any difference?
I think like it's very important for the Secretary Clinton to get China involved in the Burma case. I mean, to make regional player China and Southeast Asian nation to actively involve to pressure Burma. If she could make it so, it would be very helpful.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Min Zin is a teaching fellow at the University of California, Berkeley, who has worked with Aung San Suu Kyi in Burma. The producers of To the Point are Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Andrea Brody, Katie Cooper, Sonia Geis, and Gary Scott. Our technical director is Mike Newport. Our managing producer is Karen Radziner. Special thanks to Rebecca Mooney. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.